Hello and welcome to Sustainable Growth Out Loud, a podcast brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice. I'm your host, Julia Bottaro, and I hope you miss me because I haven't been here for a while, but I'm very excited to be back.
We missed you.
Thank you. I'm here with my colleagues, Felicia Jackson and Heather Dinwoody. How are you doing today?
Great, thank you very much.
Not too bad, thanks.
And happy birthday, Felicia.
Thank you.
So today we have, as ever, three great stories that we think are a great indication of what's going on in the markets. So I will start with mine. So today I'm talking about Amazon sustainability report that came out last week. I think there is a lot to talk about. So I've taken three main points from it that I would like to discuss. So first of all, the company managed to decouple its emissions from growth. So what does it mean? It means that its carbon footprint was reduced while its sales went up. This was between 2021 and 2022. So sales were actually up by 9% to over $500 billion, a huge number. And the CO2 instead went down by 0.4%, which is obviously great. But I don't think at this rate the company will be able to achieve net zero by 2040. And while it's important to celebrate this achievement in the recent year, it's important to remember that emissions actually went up by 30% between 2019 and 2022. So there is a lot to do here. The second point I wanted to discuss is something that I think is very positive. So the company said it will update its supply chain standards and it will ask its suppliers to provide data on their emissions, and it will also help them in their decarbonization journey. This is very important because it will help Amazon calculate its scope 3 emissions better, but I also think it will help other companies calculate their scope 3 emissions better if they share the same suppliers. And also, I think because obviously Amazon, it's a huge company, it's worth over $1 trillion, and it's got lots of resources. So it's great that it actually helps the smaller players in achieving net zero. And then the final point that I wanted to make, which for me was the main point, if you go and read the story on our site. So I asked the company, I was reading through the report and I saw that there wasn't much mention of biodiversity or nature. So I asked Amazon, what are you doing to calculate and address your impacts on nature? And I don't think I got a response on this. I got a response saying that in terms of biodiversity, the company is both acting as a catalyst for the industry. So it leads alliances, it pushes forward sector-wide commitments. And on the other hand, it has also created a fund. So it invests loads of money, actually, I think billions over the course of a few years. But it invests money in projects like tree planting or protecting coasts and things like that. But, you know, these projects are outside of the company. You know, they're not addressing the impacts that its own operations have on nature. And so that made me think, does Amazon have carbon tunnel vision, which means that it's only focusing on its emissions? But we know that the environmental impact of a company is way more than just the emissions. And, you know, I think the whole biodiversity discourse is quite new. But since maybe COP15, there's been a real momentum in understanding the impact that companies have on nature. But a company as big as Amazon, as powerful as Amazon, I feel it should be doing more. What do you think?
I think it's really interesting you say that, Julia, because, you know, as well as their impacts on nature, it's also dependencies on nature. You know, a lot of Amazon's business will rely on certain services and assets that are only found and provided by nature. I've read through your article and I noticed that sort of the majority share of their emissions reductions have come within their scope too, which is all about sort of the energy they purchase and whatnot. And I can't help thinking that it's a bit of a sort of a low-hanging fruit sort of thing. You know, you switch everything over to renewable energy, and that's great. I'm not saying it's not. But it is ultimately the low-hanging fruit when it comes to decarbonizing a business. And it would just... I mean, have we got any sort of a transition plan for what are the next steps? How are they going to achieve that net zero by 2040, I think you said? Because you can't just shove a target there and say that, yep, we're going to get it. We need to have the steps in place.
That is so true. But I think it's almost important to take a step back. There is so much to unpack in this story that it kind of beggars belief, because it's absolutely brilliant that Amazon has decoupled growth from emissions, because there's a huge argument that's going on at the moment about whether or not we should be targeting absolute emissions reduction, whether we should allow it to be emissions intensity reduction if you're a growing company. Because it's one thing if you are a company the size of Amazon at $500 billion in sales, but what if you're a small company who's got a disruptive technology, who's trying to displace an entire industry? You have to grow to displace that industry. But if you grow, you won't be able to have a target that's acceptable by everybody, by the general population, by public perception. It's so complicated, because at the same time, this tunnel vision issue, I think, is incredibly important. There was some research that was done 8 years ago by Trucost about natural capital dependencies. So what it would cost a business, what it would cost business generally to operate if it had to pay for its impact on nature. Now, this was, I think, calculated to be $7.3 trillion a year. But out of that, less than 40% of the cost was related to CO2 emissions. Things like clean air, water pollution, access to materials. These things are a fundamental part of business operations, and they're not even being considered. The carbon tunnel vision, I think, is something everyone has to be concerned about. But I think there's another thing that comes up with this story, which is time horizon and context. Because addressing scope 1 and 2 emissions, which is effectively what Amazon has done, was a fantastic place to start 2 or 3 years ago. We're in a very different place today. You know, the weather attributions service from Imperial's come out and basically said the heat waves we're having in the US and Europe, they wouldn't have happened without climate change. And there's really terrible things that come along with that in human terms, but there's also massive costs. You've got infrastructure melting, you've got worker productivity, you've got impact on the health system, and none of these things are being paid attention to. It's almost like everyone knows that the economy and the environment is interconnected. People's lives, the way we live, the way we work, it's all interconnected. But if you ignore it to focus on one tiny part of it, you're missing the big picture and missing an opportunity to change the way we do things. And then don't even get me started on Amazon and its third-party suppliers, because the inability to deal with scope 3 with a company the size of Amazon, yes, it's incredibly complex. We all know it's complex. They're talking about setting guidelines. They're talking about standardization. This has got to be done between industries, across sectors. We've got to find a different way of doing things, because we know we need standardization for comparability. We know we need to make it easier for companies to report. There is the argument that oil companies use that they don't need to worry about scope 3 because their entire scope 3 emissions are somebody else's 1 and 2. Well, there's an argument there. I'm not sure it's one I completely support. But the point is, everything is related to everything else. And I just fail to understand how people can't see this more clearly, and how governments and corporations and individuals aren't trying to recognize we need to work across these boundaries.
Well, I think that the point that you made about going across boundaries is a nice segue into the next story, which we will discuss after the break.
In a world where the scarcity of key resources is starting to be felt and the impact of climate change is all too apparent, sustainable growth is no longer a choice, it is a necessity. Sustainable Growth Voice is a new online publication championing individuals and organisations that are pushing sustainable growth forward, making a positive impact on the environment, society and the economy. From innovative technologies solving sustainability challenges to social enterprises promoting inclusive growth and transformative policy initiatives, SG Voice covers the fundamental drivers at the heart of the new sustainable economy. Join the conversation that the world needs now. Visit SG Voice for knowledge, inspiration, and insight from across the sustainable growth landscape.
We are back from the break, and Heather, I believe you have a story for us on the OECD.
Yeah, absolutely, Julia. So we were chatting there about sort of bringing these things into a more sort of systemic approach that crosses different boundaries, and I have a relatively positive story to share on that note. So this is a new agreement that has been reached between 11 members of the OECD, and I could try and rattle them off. I will be counting down on my fingers, but we've got the UK, we've got the EU, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Norway, Switzerland, Turkey, Japan, and Korea.
Well done.
Very impressed. I believe that's 11. Took me a while. I need to find some sort of way of remembering them. But anyway, so between these 11 countries, now for a long time, for decades and decades, they've had an agreement on how they will use export credits. So this means that the export credit agencies of those countries will all sort of follow the same general terms when financing overseas projects. So this could be anything from insuring an overseas project to sending direct credits for the countries in question. But it's essentially a form of borrowing where a company in a country borrows money in order to allow them to export overseas. And with this new arrangement, what they've done is they've agreed that they can offer more flexible terms for climate-friendly projects, which may sound quite broad, and it is, but they've expanded the sector that this will allow for to include sort of green manufacturing, low carbon transport, green hydrogen, renewable energy, and any project in those areas will be able to repay their loans over, I think they've got an extra 4 years now they can be offered, and they've got sort of more flexible repayment options in place. All these kinds of things just to make it easier for companies to trade in green activities, as it were. And I think this is really interesting to me because it's, as Fee said, it is crossing boundaries, but it's also a win-win for everyone, really. For companies, it makes it easier to expand, to get these solutions out there. As these solutions do get out there, they're helping other countries to meet their own targets. So for example, if you're a country that said we're going to have this much renewable energy by this point, it's easier for developers to get into that country and achieve that. And then of course, for the country that is exporting, you've got all the economic benefit of competing on that scene. So it's really, as I say, it's mutually beneficial, and it's...
Oh, sorry, I was just going to add, one of the things that's incredibly cool about this is that as you get that economic growth from expansion internationally, and you get the country having access to technology, because there's more focus on those sales, the price is likely to come down. Because the more a market expands, the lower the price becomes, the more that is bought, the cheaper it gets. That's exactly what happened with wind and solar.
That's what I was going on to.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
And I think, no, you're fine. I mean, it's an exciting thing to talk about, frankly, because it's nice to have a ray of hope occasionally. But yeah, I think, I would think of the example of sort of green hydrogen. Green hydrogen is in such high demand and it's at such high cost at the moment. But if you're making it easier for countries to export that green hydrogen, it begins to expand all over the place and those costs can begin to come down. So, I personally can't actually think of anything to criticize here. I think it's great news and hopefully others will follow suit, because by lowering those trade barriers, what can we achieve?
Yeah, you're encouraging something really positive to happen.
I'm just wondering how this will play into the whole competition to achieve net zero, because it's something that in the UK we discuss a lot about, because, the UK government is doing what it's doing and everyone is like, oh, the UK is now left behind. It was such a leader in the net zero. And now with the IRA in the US and all the amazing policies coming from the European Union, So it always feels like in these conversations, to me, feels like you have to win, like you have to be the one party that emerges first. While here it seems like we're going to even the playing field and everyone wins.
Well, actually, I think, Julia, there's something to be said for evening the playing field. I think that can still encourage competition, because what it means is that, you know, instead of countries doing their trade in accordance with like where it's easier to set up. So say if the UK was awarding really, really flexible terms and it was all great, all the UK companies would be exporting their goods. Everyone would just be choosing the UK because that's what they could get. Whereas when you've got a whole bunch of different countries who will all be sort of equally able to export their goods, then it kind of encourages competition, because the decision between where you're importing from then comes down to quality, it comes down to pricing, it comes down to which is better. So I think by evening the playing field in terms of trade, you're actually spurring some innovation, because, you know, there's more players on an equal field, so someone's got to do better if they want to win.
But I think that's true, but there's a couple of other things that I think are really important on a macro scale. One of which is, this is about getting preferable debt when you're looking to expand. One of the things we always discuss with, you know, traditional business models versus sustainable is that a lot of the time, implementing something sustainable, implementing something renewable, often has a greater upfront cost. And that can be really challenging in a time of high inflation and high interest rates. What this is actually allowing companies to do is access to preferential debt through export. Now, you have to be of a certain size to be able to do that, but it's about countries coming together and saying, let's prioritize what's better for the planet as well as what's better for our economy. Because they all want to export. Everyone wants to grow their markets. But if you're growing your market through a product that is actually displacing something that does damage, that's a win-win-win, as I think you said in your article, which I loved.
I did indeed, yeah. I think there were also some stats there, which, you know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but export finance is actually extremely, extremely powerful. And, you know, over the past few years, it's been spending a lot more money on fossil fuels projects, whether it be coal or something else. Whereas if we can get the share of renewable energy or whatever it is that's being given these preferential terms, we can shift that balance so that green becomes the norm, so that that is what... Sorry, Fee, I can see your mouth opening. What have we got?
No. I was just thinking about how this is a signal of companies acting together towards the realignment of capital. And one of the things I think the last couple of years, at least the last 18 months, you know, the Ukraine war, the energy crisis, fear about energy security, it's seen a lot of governments shift back and, you know, do open new licensing for the North Sea, for example. There's a focus on fossil fuel. You've seen a lot of fossil fuel companies move away from renewables. But I think we're forgetting that governments and industries work on different timeframes. It takes a really long time to get governments to agree details. I know that the codes by which international trade is tracked change once every 5 years. We only got aspects of solar plants in them a year or two ago, if that. So perhaps what's really happening is governments are beginning to implement those things which they promised to in order to build us towards a net zero future. And industries are responding to short-term concerns, because that's what this all boils down to, isn't it? You know, what are your trade-offs? Short-term success, long-term success. Short-term impact, long-term impact. And who are you trying to talk to? Who are you trying to impress? Until everyone can work out what that is, I don't see it coming together.
Well, I think that's a nice way to end this segment. We're going on a break and we have one more story for you.
Evergreencast is the latest podcast series from Sustainable Growth Out Loud. This two-part series is brought to you in paid partnership with Scottish Woodlands and the Confederation of Forest Industries. We'll be exploring some of the challenges and opportunities of sustainable forestry. For our first episode, I'm joined by David Robertson, Director of Investment and Business Development at Scottish Woodlands, and Stuart Goodall, Chief Executive at the Confederation of Forest Industries. We'll be touching on some of the opportunities that sustainable forestry has to offer, from carbon sequestration to timber construction and job creation, as well as some of the changes that can bring these possibilities into reality. This podcast is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back from the break, and Felicia, I believe you're talking to us about the SBTI.
I am indeed. And it's actually not just the SBTI, but it's the SBTI really caught my attention this week as a hook for a wider discussion about corporate reporting. So a few days ago, a bunch of NGOs sent a letter to the SBTI asking them to update its standards in line with the recommendations of the UN High Level Expert Group. So they launched a report at COP27 called Integrity Matters, and it was guidelines for how countries and cities and corporations should report in order to avoid greenwash. Now, the SBTI is in a sticky situation. It has increased the number of companies that are reporting to its standards massively in the last couple of years. That's an incredibly positive trend and one that should be encouraged. But there are challenges in the way in which these work. So, for example, one of the things that changing markets brought up was issues around the agricultural giant JBS. So JBS put forward a proposal to the SBTI to show how it would sort of saying it was going to achieve net zero emissions. The thing about the SBTI is you can put forward, you can say you're going to sign up, and then you've got 2 years to actually come together with a plan. That was actually supposed to have been supplied by JBS earlier this year, but it hasn't been. So what does the SBTI do? You know, it has a framework that everyone understands it to have. And I think it's become almost a litmus, no, maybe not a litmus test, but a fire starter or something, but it's that point of contention. Does having an SBTI target make you gold standard performer on the climate front, or is it an excuse to not take action yet, to delay things? I think they're unfair questions, but this is why I thought the discussion about corporate reporting is so important, because the lack of understanding of context, I think I mentioned this earlier in one of our previous stories, but decisions that were made 2 years ago may not be the same decisions that are made today. So one of the other things that came out was Planet Tracker doing a report on BASF's performance. It only covers scope 1 and 2 emissions as well. 80% of this chemicals group emissions is not covered by its reporting. So it's not in line with achieving net zero, and yet it can actually talk very happily about how it's addressing its emissions. We've got a bigger conversation to have, which is we need to support companies in taking action and moving forward as fast as they can. We can't criticize them for not being able to move faster until we give them the right tools, the right support, and the right incentives to act the way that we need them to. So it's one thing to say, we know it's a problem. That's great. But do you remember, what's the thing they always say about work? What does the boss want? The boss doesn't want to know what the problem is. The boss wants to know what the solution is. So if we want people to do things differently, we have to find ways to help them do things differently. So actually, the criticism of the SBTI, I think, is really potentially helpful if it's responded to in a way that enables everyone involved to move forward in an active and effective way. And that does mean addressing scope 3 emissions. It does mean moving beyond the value chain. It means understanding impact and understanding your dependencies on nature. Because that's the other thing. Sorry, but I'm going to go back to the Amazon story and the thing about carbon tunnel vision.
I think this speaks to the confusion that still exists in the market, because someone, a big company like BASF, going, oh, look how good we are, scope 1 and scope 2, you know, are they getting away with the kind of widespread ignorance of the importance of scope 3 emissions? And I think this is why it's so important to talk about it. And I agree with you, you know, it's not about attacking SBTI, it's about starting a conversation, it's about, you know, correcting the course that we're taking. And yeah, like it shouldn't be acceptable to have a plan without Scope 3 emissions.
I mean, you asked there, Fi, you said, you know, is SBTI, is it, does it mean that you're the gold standard actor, or does it mean that you don't have to act for a while? I mean, the way I see it, it's neither. Like, SBTI is about a target, it's a goalpost. You know, that doesn't say anything about how you're acting now or when you should act. What that said, well, I suppose it is when you should act, but...
And how? Don't forget the hows matters.
Well, this is what I was going to say. It's like, so setting a target means neither of those things. How you act defines those things. What you do defines those things. You know, you can't just say, you know, I hope that I get an A in my maths exam next year. That makes me good at maths. But you also can't say, I hope I get an A in maths next year. I'll work on it next year. You know, it's not like that. You'll get an A in maths if you work on your maths.
We should use this example more widely.
Yeah, there's a really interesting thing, actually. FTSE Russell, there was a piece they came out with where they did historical analysis of companies that had targets before 2020. And I think it was just under half managed to hit those targets. So while we're talking about standards for forward-looking action, we actually need to think about standards for what people are doing now, what they have done. What can we tell from historical performance? What does that tell us as an indicator of what's likely to happen next? And I think maybe that's where this all comes together, this idea that we do need to look beyond carbon. We do need to look at nature, but more than anything, we actually need to see what people are doing. And we're having discussions about mandatory reporting, and there are different voluntary standards for reporting, but they're kind of, even then, they're historical. You know, we need new ways of thinking about this. I'm not saying I've discovered one. I'm just saying that there feels like there's a real gap in our understanding that's increasingly hard to articulate as everybody tries to own their bit of the reporting market.
I think that's so true because, you know, there is a value in setting targets because you have to have something to aim for. You have to know what you're shooting for. And yes, it's great if everyone is kind of setting targets in the same way. But saying that you're going to achieve something doesn't mean you've achieved it. We need to create... And I worry that this expectation that people are going to set their science-based targets, it leaves some people open to fail because, you know, as we've seen from Amazon, it's a long, slow process. Like, these things are difficult to achieve. And, you know, I would rather that someone actually started doing what they could rather than worry about making a target that they might not end up breaching.
Yeah, maybe we should be looking at rate of improvement. Yes.
I think process, I think, you know, saying rate of improvement, I think, I don't know why I'm choosing to put myself in the steps of the SBTI, but, you know, maybe instead of end goals, we should be looking at more processual.
Well, to be fair to the SBTI, they do demand sort of interim goals. It's not enough just to set a goal in the future. So you will have medium term, short term, long term. And I do think that's incredibly important. And I do think they're doing a really, really good job. It's just, is the job they're doing the right one and the only one? And I can't believe I just said that, given I said we need less fragmentation. But I do feel sorry for companies that are trying to navigate this space because it is fragmented, it is confusing, and it's communicated about really badly. You know, and I think that we had that whole thing, I think, that came out last year, green hushing and companies worrying about saying what they were doing in case they got told off for not doing enough. That is a genuine problem and companies have got to be encouraged. But I think it is that action by governments creating an environment where the logical thing to do is rework your business to fit into a new paradigm. That's what we need to see.
But then one thing that a lot of people say is that the change will be spurred by the private sector. So are we in a chicken and egg situation?
Well, it is a bit chicken and egg, but, you know, the private sector effectively is designed for short-term return. So the only way we can change that framework and change the incentives for the private sector to act is through intervention. And I never thought of myself as an interventionist. But the thing is, if you want to live in a different world, you have to set different parameters for how that world is going to work.
You know, this level of systemic change seems a very easy feat, and good luck to everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. As ever, check out our website and our socials and our previous podcast episodes, why not? Thank you, and see you in 2 weeks.